everybody, and welcome to the all-new Geek Actually podcast, episode 2, even though my show notes say episode 1. The podcast that was in hypersleep but was awakened early by a distress call from LV426. Yes, that's right, folks. It's a podcast that is simultaneously about everything and nothing from a geek's perspective. It has been restored, rebooted, reimagined, reinterpreted, remade, or is it just plain back? We have no idea. We are just here, and in this week's show, we talk about news about privacy, some weird food, some creepy tech that may want to kill us, and in the film actually segment, we are going to review Tim Burton's new film, Big Eyes, and talk about how IMAX is going to get me back into the cinemas. I am David McVeigh, and I am joined by my co-host, Dave Longo. How are you, Dave?
You're a robot. God damn it, Ash, you're a robot.
That was a bit of a long-winded introduction. I'm spent. Let's go home.
How long we got? 10 minutes. 10 minutes. Is that enough time to get out of here? Well, in 10 minutes, if we're not out of here, we're not going to need a spaceship to blow out of space.
it's the only way we're going to be sure.
We'll nuke them from orbit, goddammit.
How's your week been, Dave?
Very good, Dave. Yourself?
Not too bad. We just had a marathon recording behind the panels.
We've done, I think, 5 hours total of Behind the Panels.
Oh, at least 75 hours of Behind the Panels.
Now there's an empty space in this room.
Just to explain, Richard, our co-host, Richard, our esteemed leader on panels, is actually flying to America tomorrow. Yeah. So we had to pre-record the next 2 weeks.
By the time people hear this, he'll be on the plane, I suppose.
By the time they hear this, he'll have probably finished his conference.
Yeah, damn.
This doesn't go out till Wednesday, so he'll have delivered his paper already by then.
We're early in time.
Yeah, we always are. Anyway, so first thing we want to talk about, as usual this week, is the headlines about stuff that we don't really care about. And this week we didn't care enough to actually even get any headlines. So on to the real news. Did we have a real news thing? I don't remember.
Oh, fuck that.
Yeah, whatever. Okay. All right. So first thing I want to talk about very quickly. Once again, we start a little bit more serious. We'll get onto the jocularity in a moment, but I want to pose the question, who's really in charge? Because basically the Australian federal government wants to introduce site blocking. This is all part of their whole new net strategy where, let's see if we can remember all this. First of all, they want to do data retention. They want to hold all of our data, whatever we do online, for a period of 2 years. They also want to do
everything.
They also want to be able to... Now, that raises a whole question. We got another article about that. Because that raises a whole ethical issue. Last week, we talked about the three strikes rule. Mm-hmm. And now they're basically saying that they want to introduce site blocking. Now, if you remember going back, let's put the Wayback Machine on. The Wayback Machine. We talked about site blocking. This is way before your time. When we did early Geek, actually, we were talking about the fact that the federal government was trying to do the blacklist. And all this sort of
stuff.
Right,
I think I can't remember. What's that guy's name?
Oh.
He had the lisp. Stephen Conroy?
Yeah, Conroy. Thank you very much. Yeah, yeah. And prior to him was that whack job for Howard's government. But anyway, that's all beside the point. The bottom line is, at this point in time, they want to start asking if people complain about a site, they want to then be able to put up a copyright amendment restriction on there and basically block things. Funnily enough, the ones that they talk about in this article, which was, of course, all of our news articles are sent to us by Delta Knight, our researcher. This one is actually on WS Business, I believe it is. WS Business. This is scary because actually you don't even really need to have any grounds for these. You just need to complain. But the sites that they all quote are, of course, torrent sites.
Of course.
So basically what they're saying is, we're going to block these sites for offensive content because you can get stuff.
It's such a witch hunt for the torrent sites lately.
Yeah.
This is kind of what we talked about last week. Remember, it was sort of like, why is the Pirate Bay the one that gets the most attention?
Now, according to this, it says...
But there's $100 torrent sites.
According to this, our Attorney General, George Brandis, has said there will be adequate time for consultation and for people to make submissions throughout the process. The spokesperson, the bill, the text of which is yet to be made public, which I always love that. They just basically say, yeah, we're going to introduce this bill. I tell you what, vote on it, then we'll let you read it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? This reminds me of...
The X-Files?
There's what will remain an unnamed tech company out there, and I will not name and shame them, but there is a tech company out there that actually... When you open the box to their software, it actually says by breaking the seal to the box, you agree to the terms and conditions. But the terms and conditions are inside the box.
Yeah,
so yeah,
yeah. It's like it's like saying spoilers after the fact. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. It's like, what if I didn't agree with them? I've already opened the box. Anyway.
Powerful marketing there.
Powerful marketing indeed. I should take note of the noise. By the way, we are coming to you. Possibly coming to you from the inside of a restaurant later on, because we are recording this fairly late. There may be some knocking in the background. Just ignore that. That would be my lovely wife, Katie, cooking. We are running a little late tonight. As I said, we did record 75 hours of panels.
We're a bit loopy.
And we are a bit loopy. 6:27. We should take note of that time. This is just pissing me off. And also, apparently, this particular piece of legislation for the site blocking was introduced without actually consulting with the ISPs, who will be the ones who have to do the blocking. So nice of them to let them know, you know, in advance what's going on. But the other piece of news that actually came up was about data retention. This law does my head in, and I'll tell you why. Oh, my page isn't loaded. There we go. This is, once again, Delta Knight sent this through. And basically, the article is from Gizmodo. And once again, all of our show notes are on our website with the post, and you can click on all these links that we're looking at. What gets me about this is that they're talking about what safeguards are in place for this data retention. Up until now, you would need things like court orders and stuff to be able to get people's logs and trace routes and what have you. And the part that this particular article is making mention about is sources for journalists.
Of course.
So a journalist goes out and gets a secret source. Mm-hmm. They can't protect their source anymore because there is now a data trail for 2 years that says all their communications. So they can actually track down every source that... So what this is going to mean is that we're not going to have any more whistleblowers because nobody wants to be identified.
Yeah.
This is just... What is our government up to now? It's like, really... There's better things to be wasting their time on.
The government is becoming like pseudo-hackers. You know, like Anonymous and like all those groups. Like pretty much, like if the government doesn't like something, it'll just be like, you know, what the North Korea incident with Sony. Like, well, we'll just leak emails.
You know, now, apparently they won't need to leak emails. It's all there in a audit trail for them to be able to find. The thing about this that actually bugs the hell out of me is that it seems to have done away with any kind of freedoms that we have. The other thing that does my head in about this is that the government that is currently in place at the moment is a conservative government, which believes in small government. They always talk about not being the nanny state and how the Labor governments, or in the case of America, the Democrats and so forth, all basically small L liberal governments basically all want to be nannies. They want to be the nanny state. They want to be big government. They want to control everything. This sounds like an awful lot of control.
Yeah.
This sounds a lot like they're trying to get in our faces. Sometimes I wonder if the libertarians in America have the right idea. I'm not a libertarian. I sometimes wonder if they have the right idea about saying, get out of our way,
like,
you know?
We were talking before the show even started, you know, like, it's like we're moving into another era of McCarthyism or something. Like where every single thing we say is going to be just...
Well, that comes down to the whole PC argument. Yeah. And let me just state for the record right now that this show is not a PC show. If you are sensitive... You may not want to listen to this show because we offend everybody equally.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Or we try
to. It's the South Park idea.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Offend everybody equally and nobody gets upset. Hey, do you want to know what else is affecting our freedoms right now?
Everything.
Spy planes.
Oh, no. I sense a theme.
The best... Well, the hot topic, of course, of this little news section is freedom and privacy.
Look at the image of that plane, though.
It looks like snakes on a plane.
It's a white plane with spy planes just written in red. I think... Wouldn't that be funny if that was an actual real plane? It just said spy plane.
What's really interesting about this article is not so much that we have spy planes. I think we all accept for the moment that we probably are being spied on every minute of the day.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
What's interesting about this is actually an American article. Once again, I think this is Gizmodo. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is an American article that basically says that the CIA helped the U.S. Justice Department build these spy planes. Now, let's see if you are from America, you know that the CIA is not allowed to operate within the United States. That's not their mandate. Their mandate is overseas,
of course,
espionage.
Okay, yeah.
And so if the CIA gets caught out doing stuff within the US, that's a bit naughty, right? Because in the US, we've got the FBI and Homeland Security, and we've got all our own things to deal with in the US Justice Department. So basically what they're now saying is that these spy planes, which to explain what these planes are, they actually have cells on them. And what they do is they fly around and they actually hijack the cell towers. So they're actually hearing what's on all the phone calls and stuff like that. Man. So basically as they fly by, they're getting the signals from all the cell towers because they're cell equipped. Yeah, scary stuff. But now what they're saying is, did the CIA help do this? And if they did, then that's really not
a
on.
Problem.
Yeah, because they're not supposed to be doing this
but who,
kind of shit.
Who watches The Watchmen?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And considering that the Homeland Security at the moment had to have a presidential decree put down, I think, last week, because they had no more money to pay anybody, and they had to get basically get a loan from the government to keep everybody employed.
At a certain point, I wonder what the whole purpose is, really. I mean, like, are they going
to keep us safe from the terrorists, Dave?
remember that Coppola movie, The Conversation?
Yeah.
Yeah, do you think, like, that's what people are going to be paid to do? Like, just,
I think they already
like,
are.
Well, I know, but, like, on a mass scale, like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people just listening to everything.
Yeah, it's called Homeless Security.
It's like, what do you do for a living, Dave? Oh, well, I simply just...
I listen to people's phone calls.
I've been given the 13th precinct of the North Shore Quarter. My job, my profession is to listen to Mr. and Mrs. Jones, and I have to listen to their neighbors. And
can you put on your job resume professional voyeur?
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, it'd be so boring and mundane. Like, what would they gain? Yeah.
Well, they're keeping us safe from the terrorists.
I guess so. And then you know what the justification's going to be. Well, what about if we do find a criminal, you know, or like...
Well, that's like, just one criminal is enough to basically say that it was all worthwhile.
Yeah.
Now, there is hope because there is a list of people who are basically getting pissed off.
Yeah, look at the headline, the list of pissed off organizations.
So this is from Gizmodo as well. It says, Wikipedia has just joined a list of pissed off organizations.
Can we add Geek Actually Network?
Yeah, I would love to. The NSA is being sued by many, many, many people. So this is the National Security. And basically, if you look down here, they're being sued by Pan America, Wikimedia, Rutherford, the National Magazine,
Human Rights Watch,
the churches, Washington Office of Latin America, Global Fund for Women, Greenpeace, Human Rights Watch.
There are some gun nuts too. Like,
oh, of course. And if you go down this list, there are some really whacked out people here when you get down.
There are a lot of people on this list. This is not like
this is a very long list. And there's some really, and there is actually a space on the list. And I'm wondering if they're going, these are the real people and these are the whack jobs.
Yeah. Then there's the other list that's not on here. It's like the mafia, you know, like
the terrorists.
Yeah, that's right.
Al-Qaeda. They're interfering with our business.
I don't understand. We applied to be on this list.
Oh, look, the Shalom Center is on here. Yep.
Wait a minute, Dave. One of these says here, New Jersey Waste Management. we better not annoy them.
So basically, these people are suing them, basically saying that this spying has to end. It's gotten to a point where, why are we being watched constantly about everything? And whatever happened to the Fourth Amendment, freedom of speech? What happened to a bunch of our basic civil rights? Now, I will point out that when you voted in the Bush government and when the Patriot Act was put forward, everybody just voted on it without even reading it. You've only got yourselves to blame. But at the same time, why hasn't a lot of this stuff been repealed? We are years down the track from everything now. Can we kind of roll it back just a little bit?
Yeah.
You know? I'm going to say it once. I've said it before on the show. I'm going to say it again, and it's a controversial statement. I know it's a controversial statement, but it's something I believe. You can't have a war on terror. Terror is not an enemy.
Yeah, it's a concept.
It's a concept, all right?
It's like the war on drugs. It's like
the
it's
bottom line like, is, if you get scared and you chip away at your own civil liberties, they have won. They have won by making you scared. The only way to win a war on terror is not be scared. Yeah. That's the only way to do it. Fighting back and blowing up countries does not stop it. All it does is throws fuel on the fire. So, controversial or not, there's my serious statement for the day.
Yeah, and it's kind of like scary because it's like all the kind of protesting stuff that's happening at the moment. It's like, well, there are people out there that will go to pretty big lengths to fight this kind of notion, you know?
So should we now. Should I move on to something a little bit lighter? And as in the notes of Professor and the rest. This was my favorite story of the week. This is a new toy coming out. Once again, I thank you, Delta Knight, for bringing this to my attention. This is from, what is it, Uncle Milton's? Uncle Milton's new toy, which is a Jedi Holocron. So if you've seen the prequel trilogy, you know the Holocrons are the source of all knowledge, mm-hmm. and they carry all the information. This is one of those
toys. And one of them was stolen from the Jedi Council library.
There you go. Yeah. This is actually a 20 questions toy. And you can actually get them in different modes. There's a Doctor Who one and so forth. They're releasing the Jedi Holocron. And basically, it will answer questions. So you think of something, and then it asks you questions, and you respond with answers. And it tries to make a guess as to whether or not it's right within 20 questions. This thing is scarily accurate. And how do I know that? Because right now, if you follow the show notes, you can go to their website. And they actually have a simulator for it because what they're doing is they're building the information to go into the toy.
Of course.
And you can actually go play with it. And I played with it for hours the other day. And let me tell you, in less than 10 questions, I was thinking of Lobot and it guessed it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's pretty freakily scary how accurate
that's
this
like
is.
That's like a Turing test.
Yes.
Like that's crazy.
I mean, it's Lobot, for God's sake. Yeah.
Did you at one point think that the Holocron may not be a robot?
And look, you know, I am helping program it, which could lead to my destruction.
This is the beginning of our doom, Dave.
But yeah, so I do suggest you all go and have a look at the website where you can actually play with the questioning on it. And the actual device itself will be out, I believe, later this year. It's what's called a 20Q toy or 20 questions toy. But it's fun. I want one of these.
I want this now.
I want it now too. Yeah. But yeah, you basically answer yes, no questions, and it'll ask you things like, is it a planet? Blah, da, da, da. And you know, and you go, no, yes, no, yes. And it guesses it. It's freaky.
That's crazy.
I know.
Especially when you said Lobot.
I know. Let's see. I might be able to follow.
Normal people don't know who Lobot is.
Oh, exactly. Okay, here we go. This is the website. And you basically come in here and you say, go to the store.
Oh, we're going
to
try it now in
Why
real
not?
Time?
Why yeah, not?
This is awesome.
I don't know if our internet connection is going to be good enough here because we don't have the NBN here. All right, so first you got to put in a couple of things. So I'm going to say I'm male and I'm 47 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm old.
In a row?
In a row. And I'm in Australia. Now, okay. Can I point out that it didn't actually have Australia on this list the other day? I had to go into other and put in Australia, and now suddenly it says Australia.
Yeah.
Oh, freaky.
We're changing the world.
And then we're going to say play. All right, so now it's going to say.
Now we got to pick who we're going to
play. All right, so. Is it, so we have to think of something.
Okay.
So think of something. Think of something and tell me what it is.
Okay, let's. What's Chewbacca's home planet?
Okay, Chewbacca's home
planet. Kashyyyk. Okay, the Wookiee home planet.
Is it a being, location, or technology?
Location.
Okay.
Oh, so this is not the voice. This is just we're doing the questions.
No, we're just answering the questions. So it's going to try and guess.
Okay, sure.
Okay.
Yep.
Are they helpful?
Yes.
Is Kashyyyk helpful?
I guess so.
Okay, well, let's have a... Or is it irrelevant? You can actually answer the different questions.
I don't know. What do you think? Remember, they were invaded and...
Yeah. Are they helpful? Let's say yes. Why not? Yeah. Can they be deadly?
Yes.
Well, yes, I guess so. They rip arms off of
they're
people.
They're Wookiees.
Yes. Are they involved in the Senate?
Are they?
I don't think Wookiees are.
I can't remember.
I don't know. Let's say unknown.
I think maybe. Yeah, unknown, yeah.
Are they part of the Rebel Alliance? Well, yes.
Yeah, I would say
they are now.
Yes.
Are they covered in fur?
No.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Does it have glaciers? No. Is it a sphere? Yes. And then we say, this is great radio, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are they large? Yes. And then we say, is this someone specific? No.
No.
No. Let's have a look. Could they be a hero? Well, no, it's a planet. So let's say irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a planet.
Oh!
I am guessing that it's Kashyyyk.
Holy crap.
How good? 10 questions it got that in.
Wow.
It got that
in. Oh, so let's say it's wrong and try and trick it.
Another time I'll let you play with it in your own time. But how fun is that?
That was crazy.
And we can get that in the form of a holocron. So that's going to be wild stuff. Okay, so from toys, let's go into Will I Am.
No, you pronounced it wrong. It's how my friend pronounces it. It's William?
William. All right, so question is, Will I Am a cosmic wackadoodle or a visionary prophet? Okay, you decide because he's basically saying that if we print a 3D human...
Wait, before we move on, I saw an, I was looking through Facebook and there was an article which was like, Will I Am says the secret to success. And so it was like one of those suggested posts to watch. You know, it's like I clicked it. And it's Will I Am and he's rambling on about nonsense for ages. And he finally gets to the advice. And
right.
He goes, the secret to success is to read the Wall Street Journal every day. That's how you get your information. That's how you know how real smart people work. And I was like, wait, so that's the secret to success
is to read the Wall Street. Like, all right.
So that's just to put that in front of this so that we don't really take it too seriously.
Well, we also have to state
that, and where is the love?
We also have to state that Will.i.am is a shareholder in a 3D printing company. All right.
He's got the Spock symbol wrong. In the
it's double-handed Spock symbol. Anyway, he says in an interview,
it's W for William.
Basically, I love the way that Gizmodo writes. Basically, saying he's pushing his batshit agenda.
Yeah, that's in the actual text. Where is this from, Gizmodo? Okay,
it says 3D printing humans may sow our moral destruction.
I think this was a song that they misconstrued as an interview.
Basically, what he's saying is that we're going to get to a point where if we can print, he's saying we can print at the moment organs and hearts. And so if we get to a point where we can actually print a 3D human.
Oh, then you could put that holocron in the
Will I Am. It's called cloning.
Yeah, that's okay.
And I'm sure there's laws about it already. It says, quote him, if you can print a liver or a kidney, God dang it, you're going to be able to print a whole freaking person.
This guy's an idiot.
Now we're getting into a whole new territory. Moses comes down with the Ten Commandments and says, thou shalt not. He didn't say shit. He didn't say shit about 3D printing.
And my 11th commandment is, thou shalt never 3D print.
Oh, Jesus. He says, you're starting with beef and leathers and body parts. Eventually, it'll get more complex. It's basically beam me up, Scotty. He goes, a 3D printer that disintegrates the source.
Star Trek is pretty cool.
Star Trek is pretty cool because they had things like iPhones and the internet. When did Star Trek have iPhones and the internet? They also had 3D printers. That was the beam me up, Scotty teleportation.
He's trolling them. There's one up here where I lost the place. So it was like something about like if you have God tools. Where is it? We have to find it.
It's here.
Yeah. When you have God-like tools, who's governing me? I don't know. I can create life. So new codes and morals beyond laws.
Will I Am, you are... I love you. Man, you are nuts.
He could be one of the pioneers of artificial intelligence.
Well, if we can 3D print people, that means...
Look,
sorry?
If we have an artificial Will I Am, it's still a step forward.
Do you know what, though? I think if we can actually print people, we might be heading a little bit closer, too.
Yes, your move, creep.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, further evidence of the impending robot apocalypse, and I, for one, salute our robot overlords. Before we go any further, I need to make that very clear, because when they come for me, I'm going to be... First, we need to bow down. But
exponential growth, people.
You remember Terminator 2. Mm. They have actually made liquid metal that moves under its own power.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So basically, it uses... Now, I'm going to get all this wrong, but New Scientist reports. So this was a Gizmodo article, but it originally comes from New Scientist. And basically, it's a small drop of metal alloy whose constituents are gallium, which is liquid... which is a liquid metal, indium, and tin, dropped into an appropriate liquid, in these examples, sodium hydroxide, but salt water also works. The scrap of metal and a scrap of aluminium for fuel, it will then move under its own power. Mm. So basically, it's a little liquid metal engine.
Wow.
So all we got to do now is make that on a bigger scale and make him turn into Robert Patrick.
And put the holocron inside.
And put the holocron inside so that it's basically harmless because all it'll know is Star Wars information.
Right, Still, a step forward in the right direction.
I think we're definitely... But until we have liquid metal people that can basically do anything, we should also talk about the fact that while we have just normal robots in the moment... let's make them so that they can disguise themselves, because we have basically just invented synthetic chameleon skin. So some scientists have actually worked out how chameleons, finally have worked out how chameleons change color and have integrated that into an artificial form. So now we could actually have an artificial skin from a previous robot apocalypse that has feelings, can feel temperature, and now can change color. So we can actually have camouflaged robots. Let's put the holocron inside that one. So it's a bit scary. So
like, this is amazing how far, like, I know from like the AI stuff, it's like you have soft and hard artificial intelligence. Yeah. And it's like soft artificial intelligence is supposed to be like the mind working, the emotions, mm-hmm. and all. And the hard stuff is all this stuff, like skin and the actual mechanics. And it's like, how far ahead are we in the hard stuff?
You know
the
what?
Hard stuff. Like, all it takes is like,
I just want to put it all together.
We need one breakthrough with the soft AI. And, then,
and you know what, though? The biggest downside of it all at this point is all going to come down to battery life. These robots are, Chappie.
Yeah.
These robots are going to come and try and take over the world, and they're going to go out of power.
Yeah, that's right.
Because we all know from our phones, they don't last a day.
No, that's right.
The shortest robot apocalypse in history.
Yeah, we should have worked this out beforehand.
Oh dear. So yes, the robot apocalypse is upon us, and it's getting scary. And you know what, these last couple of weeks we've talked about, you know, things, and these have been minor ones. We have talked about some pretty severe ones over the years, and what I'm waiting for is the next good DARPA article.
Yeah.
DARPA is determined to kill us all. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so what we're waiting for is the next big DARPA article. So Delta Knight, that's what you're looking for. Okay.
This is amazing.
I think we should move on to some film, because we actually have film news this week. So we do this. Because film actually was a podcast that became a section. Well, actually, let's go back. Film actually was a section that became a podcast that's gone back to being a section.
Oh, no, I've gone cross-eyed.
And it starts like this.
It'll be much less terrifying if you just come to me.
Mothman's got hearts. Make love in a hammock.
Yes, welcome to film. Actually, we're already doing the show, so I'm not going to do a whole introduction. So,
you almost went into it, Dave.
I did. It's the music, and music makes me want to do it. So this article I love, and I'll bring the article up in just a second, because I just wanted to bring the headline to this and say that according to this article, Australian viewers watch more Australian content on TV than US content on TV. So on TV, they're watching their Australian shows and things like, you know, My Kitchen Rules and all this stuff. Those all rate really well in Australia. They're not watching the US stuff. I have a theory.
I don't understand this, actually.
I have a theory. So basically, in Australia, TV ratings.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I get you.
They're watching more Australian content than American content.
I misread it. I thought it was then US.
No, no, than the US. No. They're watching more Australian content on Australian television than they're watching US content on Australian television.
I thought it was then the United States.
No,
I was like, well, of course.
No. And I have a theory on this. So this is basically the headline on news.com.au says, Aussie viewers snub American TV
video's
shows.
Autoplay.
Thank you.
Autoplay pause.
Disaster averted. It says Aussie viewers.
Because we're on an Australian website. Yeah. That's why it's like, give us the money.
It says that they're locally made programs such as My Kitchen Rules. Now, I have a theory about this. Why do you think this is, Dave? What's your theory on this? Why are Australians watching more Australian content on TV than they are American content?
I would say it has to do with availability.
I would say that they've already watched all the American content because they're watching it on download. And then all that's left on Australian TV is Australian content because they've already watched the latest episode of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Game of Thrones and everything else. Is that a valid theory? Let's see what they say. It says here in the article, instead it is locally made shows such as My Kitchen Rules, Offspring, Love Child, The Block, and MasterChef that have been viewers' favorites. It says Channel 10 will be hoping to beat the curse when it premieres American sitcom The Odd Couple. Oh, fuck. I've seen The Odd Couple, dude.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Oh, can we talk about that one you've been watching?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I saw the preview for that. I was like, whoa.
It's not.
I kind of like Thomas Lennon. I think he's quite funny.
And could he be any funnier?
Yeah, that's we've got Matthew
Chandler
Perry's, yes.
in it. You know, and Chandler is... we'll come back to that in just a minute. So basically it's saying Channel 10 is hoping to beat this curse when they premiere The Odd Couple. Not gonna happen, because The Odd Couple premiered on American TV 5 weeks ago, I think it was, which means that everybody's already watched it. and they're also saying, but the glory days of CSI Crime Scene Investigation, Desperate Housewives,
the
Two and a Half
glory
Men,
days.
Lost, and Grey's Anatomy ruled the local ratings. That's because all of these shows are available on torrent sites. Or through US streaming sites what have you. Nobody is watching American content because they've already watched it. That's the argument here. They seem to be in this weird idea that because Australian shows are rating... Do you know why these Australian shows are watched on TV? Because if you've ever been to a torrent site, none of these shows are there. Yeah.
And also, they all get to play in prime time, where our favorite shows
get logged at
11:30 in the... Yeah.
Look, I'm not promoting everybody to go out and pirate stuff. I'm just saying that an article like this is bullshit.
Yeah.
Because they're not looking at the overall fact here. The overall facts are our networks have bottlenecked television to a point where the viewers who want to see stuff are already watching it. They're not waiting for television.
And there's so much bullshit that the Australian networks do. There's all this infighting and madness about it. I mean, like, there's things like where, like, there'll be, like, Arrow will be showing on one channel at a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll know that most people watch this other program on the other channel. And so they'll purposefully extend it out so it cuts into the beginning of Arrow.
Yeah.
And then so people have to go, well, do I miss my show or do I watch Arrow on time?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's stuff like that. It's so
or
much info.
Or do I watch that show on TV and I'll just download a copy of Arrow? You know, I'll watch that later.
I think there's something in our guidelines or whatever, guidelines or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
It's like that we, as advertisers, we have to have a certain amount per hour, like by limit.
Yeah.
We can't exceed that. And so it's like here they force it out.
Yeah.
Whereas America, I think, they have the choice. Whether or not they will or not?
I think there's still a certain number of advertising blocks, and it all depends on who's actually bought the advertising. Mm. So advertising is dependent
on how
much
they've sold. The guidelines I'm thinking of specifically are like if you've advertised to air from 7:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. in America, that has to happen.
Yeah.
And so if you go over that, you get fined.
Right.
And where in Australia, there is no restriction. So you can run it over, you can extend your ads out completely, entirely.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and you don't get fined. There's no arbitration.
If we're wrong about this, please write into us.
Yeah, I might be wrong. I might be talking out of my ass. I really don't remember. It's a while ago I read this. And so it's like, that's the kind of thing. Australian shows, they'll fill them with ads to extend them out to fight other networks. It's all this infighting.
Interesting.
Nonsense.
Yeah. Bottom line
Hence, like, oh, well, I'm surprised Arrow got moved to, like...
But the bottom line is Arrow on TV is still 6 months behind.
Well, yeah, and that too. You know? Yeah.
It's Australian TV is a joke at the moment.
I wonder what's going to happen when Netflix actually hits and if it's as big as everyone's.
We're
going to
find out soon, aren't we? Because it's only, what's the date today?
It's only the 22nd?
It's only 2 days away.
Oh, really?
24th it launches.
Yeah, that's
so by the time this episode
and the guy
airs,
that plays Daredevil's coming here.
Sorry?
The guy that plays Daredevil is going to be
here. Oh, really?
Here.
That's not coming out until next month. So that's still about 3 or 4 weeks away. But the actual Netflix launches on the 24th.
Wow. Exciting.
So interesting. All right. What have we been watching, dude?
You've been watching The Odd Couple.
Look, I saw the pilot episode of The Odd Couple, and yes, it has Chandler Bing in it, playing against type because he's playing the Oscar Madison character.
Sure, yeah.
And it was moderately amusing. It had some. Who's the actor who plays Felix?
Thomas Lennon,
yeah. And it's a moderately amusing show. That you sit there and look at it and go, why the hell are we remaking this series?
Yeah.
There is nothing new to add to this. Yeah. It is recycled jokes. It is really classic sitcom, multi-camera, single set. I don't think we've seen them leave the living room yet.
Yeah.
And it just feels really old-fashioned. You know, and you sit there and go, why are we redoing this? And if they're hoping for that to bring in the viewers,
Yeah, like, yeah, if that's your flagship show, wow.
Yeah, wow. If that's, yeah. if that's all you got on offer, yeah. Yeah, that's like, not good.
See you later.
The other thing I've watched this week was back to Once Again, Once Upon a Time.
Yay.
I finished season one of Once Upon a Time.
Oh, and you didn't get two today.
I didn't get two today. No, I haven't got two yet. I'm really annoyed because I was in JB Hi-Fi the other day and I made an executive decision because they actually had them marked at two for $40. And I went, oh, I could actually get season two and three, $40. No, $40. I don't have $40 on me right now. I thought, I'll just get them on iTunes. What the hell? And I came home and I went, looked at iTunes and they are $59 a season. Wow. And I went, bite me. So I got to race back to JP.
Knowing your luck, you'll go there and the sale will be over. And yeah. They'll be like $60.
Well, they
there
are.
Again.
They're like $60. Are they? Yeah.
They're on special.
They're on special, two for $40. So, yeah, knowing my luck, I'll go back. And yeah, exactly. Special ended over the weekend. So I'm very annoyed. But season one was a lot of fun. I really did enjoy it. Mm. It is not good for me. It is not masterpiece of television, but it's fun. And I had a lot of fun watching it. And I am looking forward to season two. Dave, hang on. Ooh. I believe you've been got a little bit more news for this. So tell me a little bit about, you've actually ventured into Deep Space Nine territory.
Not yet.
Oh, not yet.
No, I bought Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
And Voyager.
All right.
The first season for each.
Right.
But I haven't begun yet.
That's very loud.
It is very loud, but it's beautiful.
There you go.
It is majestic. You get lost in it for about 15 minutes. No, I don't know. Like, I didn't get a chance to much.
Oh, hello.
Hey, whoa. Hello.
I didn't get a chance to watch any. It's been a busy week. But I did get a chance to watch the commentary for Star Trek Insurrection.
All right.
Which is Jonathan Frakes and Marina Sirtis together. And it's an awful commentary. But an amazing commentary at the same time. Like, if you're kind of like me and you enjoy it for, like, the ironic reason.
Right.
And in this one here, it's Jonathan Frakes who remembers every exact detail because he directed the movie.
Yeah.
And it's got Marina Sirtis who remembers nothing. Absolutely nothing. And so the entire commentary is Marina Sirtis asking questions about who was that guy and what has this guy been doing? And, like, what happened to him? Where did he end up being? And the whole thing is Jonathan Frakes answering questions about where people went on.
Apparently, I saw an interview with the whole cast, and apparently they all defer to Michael Dorn because he's like the holocron of Star Trek. Apparently, he remembers everything about everyone.
Yeah, yeah. And Michael Dorn's apparently the richest.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, where did he make his money?
Like investments and like buying planes and stuff. But he's Michael Dorn's, I think, been in every Star Trek ever, right? He's one of the only people.
No,
he was not like the original series, but like he was with the original crew.
Well, he was in
number six.
He's next gen. He's in Star Trek VI. He's in Deep Space Nine. He's not in
Voyager.
Yeah, okay. And he's not in Enterprise.
Because I thought I remember reading somewhere there was the only two people to have made an appearance in any version of the crew, I guess, would be Major Barrett.
Well, Major Barrett, definitely.
Yeah, and I thought Michael Dorn was added in there.
Michael Dorn's been in a few of them. I don't think he's been in every one of
maybe
them.
Maybe not Enterprise. I haven't watched Enterprise.
Major Barrett, for those who don't know, is Gene Roddenberry's wife.
Yes.
You know, God rest her soul. She's actually passed on now, but she was the original number one first officer on the original pilot that didn't get picked up. Then she became Nurse Chapel in the original series. Then in the movies, she became Dr. Chapel.
Yes.
Then in the
and next, the voice of the computer in the movies,
some of them, later movies, definitely. Mm-hmm. In the Next Generation, she became the voice of all Federation computers, plus Luxana Troi.
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine, she was the voice of the computer and Luxana Troi. Mm-hmm. Voyager, she was the voice of the computer. And then in Enterprise, there is actually some of the computers have her voice, not all of them. So she's actually made an appearance in every single incarnation of Star Trek, including J.J. Abrams.
Oh, really?
Which she was dead, but apparently they actually used some samples of her voice in some of the computers.
For the computers?
Yeah, okay, for some of the computers.
Right.
So
that's awesome.
She has actually made an appearance in every incarnation of Star Trek across. She's, I think, the only person who has done every incarnation of Star Trek, which
and
is really awesome.
Yeah, I might have been inaccurate, but like I'm still finding my way in this universe now, and I don't know everything. Like
I met Majel Barrett.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, she was at a Star Trek convention in Melbourne when I lived in Melbourne many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And I got her to sign something. It was actually for my aunt who was a big fan of Dr. Chapel. And so I got her to sign something and I said hi and all this. She was lovely. She gave a speech.
Yeah, right. Yeah, she's like the queen of Star Trek.
She's first lady of Star Trek.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. The first lady.
If Gene Roddenberry is the president of Star Trek, she's the first
exactly.
lady.
Yeah,
and she carried on his legacy after he died because he had another series that he had been developing called Andromeda.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Was it Andromeda?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, Andromeda. And it was made after he passed.
She got it produced. Yeah, mm-hmm. She pushed it forward and got it produced. It wasn't a very good show.
No, I never saw it.
She was still pushing his legacy. For years to come. So.
And it will be on forever, both their legacies. I thought what would be interesting is if we did a mini review, like a 5-minute review of each of the movies.
Oh, I'm in. Let's do it.
And we should start now with like the motion picture.
Long and boring.
My review. I like the motion picture.
All right, let's put this into context. I saw Star Trek the Motion Picture in 1979 at the cinema. And I remember being so excited.
How old were you, Dave?
I was 11, 12.
Okay. Yeah. 11, so you were 11. A young kid in Star Wars.
And Star Wars was like the biggest thing in the world, and I had seen that at the cinema. I'd seen the black hole, anything science fiction. I was mad for. I'd been watching Star Trek in reruns on television my entire childhood. I love Star Trek. I thought it was wild. And I remember when Star Trek the Motion Picture got announced, it was like I'm first in line. And I was actually in England at the time. We were actually in England when it came out, and I remember going with my friend of mine and we sat down in the cinemas and I was so excited this was it. And we actually really enjoyed it. We both came out of it just thinking this was wild. I remember building the bridge in Lego.
Yeah, at home,
and we'd actually play Star Trek on the bridge on Lego and all this stuff. And we just loved the film. We had a great time. Revisiting it later, when you have kind of a more adult eye and so forth, you look at it and go, the film has really big pacing problems.
Yeah.
It's a great...
That's so interesting that you as a kid enjoyed it.
Oh, I loved it. But then again, I was a Star Trek and science fiction junkie.
Yeah, sure.
And when I look at it back now with a critical eye, I sit there and go, you could shave an hour out of that film not lose anything. And the fact that they've done Blu-ray right now is the extended edition. You sit there and go, you didn't need to extend this movie. I mean, it literally has a 25-minute sequence where they fly and circle the Enterprise Kirk looks at it like he's about to have an orgasm, right? And you say, and there's one point where Scotty puts his hand on his shoulder, like, "Are you okay?" You know?
He's not overestimating it. It's literally like 20 minutes.
It was actually it was something that my friend and I talked about when we saw it in '79. We were saying it's almost like they went, "Look what we can do now," and they just had to show it off, you know. And so even like the trip through V'ger, that could have been shaved by 20 minutes.
Yeah.
A lot of it is, "Look what we can do." Isn't this wild? And for its day, for 1979, the special effects were amazing.
Yeah.
Douglas Trumbull did all the special effects, who did 2001, and they're just fantastic.
Even now, watching them, I think like it's one of the Star Trek movies that holds up the best.
You gotta be careful, because some of those effects have been redone. So
for
the Blu-ray and the director's cut, they actually redid some of the effects. But a lot of the original light show effects and all that, that's all original, and that's all the way it was. And a lot of that is really good stuff, and I really like that. For me, though, the Star Trek series kicks off with Star Trek 2.
Yeah.
And we'll come back to that
another
time.
Next week.
But as far as Star Trek, the motion picture is a cerebral journey. It is very much like original series. You can really see that they were trying to just bring back the original series. Mm. What they needed was a better editor and to inject a little bit more pace into it. What did you think? You've seen it recently. So.
Yeah, I really liked it, but I had the same kind of issues with it. Like, it's really overpaced. I had to watch it in two sittings because
I can see that.
I fell asleep during the first one, but immediately it was really late at night. Like it was like 2 a.m. or something, you know? And I kind of just really gravitated towards like all that stuff, like the long loving shots of the Enterprise, because I can see it through the modern context, you know, like just of like, look at the ship through, you know, like look at how amazing how technology was back then. And here it is on the big screen, like look at it, you know? And I really, really, like, admired the movie a lot more once I'd finished it.
Hmm.
Like, once it had revealed, like, the truth behind V'ger and what the actual story was, it was like, I thought it was a brilliant concept.
Yeah.
You know, and as a
Harlan Ellison helped write it, didn't he?
Did he really?
I think Harlan Ellison. I think he's one of the mini writers on, because I had a lot.
It had like seven writers.
Yeah, I think Harlan Ellison was one of them. He was also a writer on the original.
It was supposed to be like they were doing Star Trek Phase 2.
Yeah,
and it was supposed to be the pilot episode.
Yeah, so if you read anything about Roddenberry and so forth, basically he kept trying to get Star Trek back on the air after it became a hit on syndication and da-da-da-da. He had the whole thing cast. He had scripts done for the first season. He was ready to go on Star Trek Phase 2. And Leonard Nimoy didn't want to return, so they had recast, and they had Psylocke, I think his name is, or Psybocke or whatever. Psybocke actually is the brother.
That's the brother.
What's his name? Yeah. Commander?
It's not Sarek.
Yeah, it's something like that. Anyway, but basically they had him... They had him as the new Vulcan, and they'd introduced the Delton and, you know, all this sort of stuff. Mm. And then somebody at Paramount said, let's not make this as a series. Let's do this as a film.
Yeah, it was like after Star Wars came out, they were like, let's capitalize on space.
Dawn Steele was involved in Paramount at that time, and she was head of marketing. She said, we can sell this. And so they rewrote... they got some writers and they rewrote it and they turned it into Star Trek, the motion picture. Yeah. And it was actually because if you read Dawn Steele's book, she was a genius at this sort of stuff. She's also passed away now. Boy, it's just been a long time since then.
Yeah,
but
no, Harve Bennett. Harve Bennett was one of the writers on.
Well, Harve Bennett was the producer of Star Trek 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Yeah. He was the godfather
of
Star Trek through all that period of time. He's passed away too now, hasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, 2 days after Nimoy.
Oh, there you go. Oh, sad. I didn't even know. So basically, they pushed the crap out of Star Trek the Motion Picture and turned it into a hit. They actually believed, Paramount believed, if you read Don Steele's book, that when they delivered Star Trek the Motion Picture, they said, this is a bomb. Yeah. And they basically said, this is not what we wanted. This is going to die. It's never going to fly. And Dawn Steele had a different idea about that, and she did some very clever marketing, and she whipped up anticipation for this film like crazy to the point where the film was a financial success. And because it was a financial success, it spun a sequel.
Yeah.
And at that point, Paramount did probably the smartest thing they can do, and I know this is a very controversial statement, but they did probably the smartest thing they could do, which was they locked Roddenberry out. Because if Roddenberry had continued on, we would have ended up with a series of films like Star Trek the Motion Picture. Yeah. And what would have happened is they would have steadily had less and less return, and that would have all just died. Instead, Harve Bennett came on as the producer. Roddenberry served as a creative consultant. Mm. And then they did the very smart thing of hiring Nicholas Meyer, who wrote and directed Star Trek II, and basically said, what this needs is action.
Did they lock out Roddenberry completely from it? Like, because I don't know really what happens with the original series movies, but when it came to me to watch the next gen movies, I got really focused on the behind the scenes, because there's a lot of readily available material of behind the scenes of the next gen movies, whereas the original stuff, there is a lot. But it's harder to get.
You can't just go on Wikipedia.
You
kind of piece the story together, and we're talking about in an era before really the internet. So you're piecing it together by everybody's different biographies.
Yes, exactly. Where the information's kind of
and so you can't take any one biography. Mm. You take a whole bunch of different biographies and you fold them together, and you kind of wade in and out where all the same nuggets of information are coming. And if they're the same nuggets of information constantly,
then you kind of know
that's got to be the real story.
Yeah.
So by reading the two William Shatner Star Trek Memories books, by reading Gene Roddenberry's biography, by reading I Am Not Spock, and then later I Am Spock, and then by reading just recently even... Sulu's written a book as well, you know, and so you look at it and you go, as you start to piece it all together,
Chekhov has a book,
I believe.
They all must have one.
If you don't, you should, because you can capitalize on
absolutely.
But when you start piecing it together, you start to realize that Roddenberry was basically out of the Star Trek business for most part after Star Trek the Motion Picture, and it was actually,
and then I guess it's when Next Gen comes back, they
Gen was basically, he was saying, okay, well, they're doing all that with the movies over there now, he goes. And they said, we want to put Star Trek back on television. And he said, but we're going to do it my way.
Right.
And so basically when he took on Star Trek The Next Generation, a lot of it was, we're doing it my way. And you're not going to lock me out. You're not going to can the series. You're not going to do this. And he set down all the rules for Next Generation. And that's why, in fact, when you watch the first season of Next Gen, it feels very original series.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it's very much Roddenberry in control. As Rick Berman got more control and Roddenberry kind of took a back seat, the series changes and becomes a little bit more fast-paced, becomes a little bit more story, you know, less focused on the overall picture and more on characters and stuff like that. So I think in many ways you look at it and go, every step of the way, when you look at it, you go, Roddenberry was the visionary.
Yeah.
But it was the other people who actually made it work.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that, because that there's a lot of that, like, that I've been reading. And it's cool because, like, Roddenberry had strict rules, but he was maybe too strict about them.
Maybe, yeah.
Whereas Rick Berman, his sort of idea is like, well, we'll maintain that, but we'll give you some flexibility.
And let's put a little bit more into it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the flexibilities would be kind of things like they would have to bring it around at the end to maintain Roddenberry's
ideals. What's really interesting is that Roddenberry's first order of the Next Generation was no old aliens. So basically,
no Klingons,
no Romulans. The only Klingon was going to be Worf.
Yeah,
there was not
no Vulcans.
We weren't going to bring back the Klingons as an opposing force. Mm-hmm. We weren't going to bring back the Vulcans. Weren't going to play a major part in it. We weren't going to bring back the Romulans. You know, we weren't going to bring back the Tholians. You know, and all this sort of stuff. And it was like this rule basically said we're going to create everything new. and that's when the Ferengi
came
about.
The Ferengi.
And the Ferengi were a massive failure. You know, and it's like, and you start going, well, you know, we got these other guys who are pretty well known.
That's right. Yeah.
And funnily enough, the Ferengi's second appearance was actually more effective than their first. The first appearance was a waste of time.
Awful, yeah.
It was awful. And then it kind of spun in from there.
It's funny as well because the first series of the Next Gen, and we're going to be here for a while. We should probably move it on.
We'll move it on
in a second. But yeah, but the first season. Well, let's do this. We'll do the motion picture today in season one of Next Gen, and then we'll.
And then next week we'll do
Rafa Khan in season two.
Okay,
yeah, yeah. I was like, it's funny because when
you've been wanting to talk about Star Trek for so long,
I'm frothing at the mouth. Coming next.
Sorry,
week.
Sorry, folks. It is a geek podcast.
The new Star Trek episode. Anyway, I was just gonna say quickly, like the Next Gen series one. It's like when I watched it the first time, I really quite enjoyed it. But then when you see how good it gets, the Next Gen,
you start
later
to realize
on,
how
you
stilted
really
it
look
is.
Back and go, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, like,
especially when you start looking at the effects work and you start looking at just how wooden it all kind of feels. It feels really like they're trying hard, you know? And it doesn't feel natural yet. By the time you get to season three, which we'll talk about in 3 weeks, apparently, by the time you get to season three, they know their characters.
Yeah.
And they're locked in by that stage. And, you know,
and the writers all know the voices.
And there's a change in style. The photography looks different. Mm-hmm. The effects look different. The uniforms are different. So season three is actually the turning point of that show. But, you know, for season one, I guess for a show that was coming back after 30 years, it did all right.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, you look at it and go, I remember watching it. In Australia, we didn't get it on TV at first. It was being released on video. They would release two episodes a month. And so we were getting these, like, hand-delivered to
us. Yeah, like one movie every month.
Yeah, so two episodes a month. And then sometimes they weren't in order. Usually they were, but sometimes they weren't in order. I remember we were in the middle of season two, I think it was, when suddenly Best of Both Worlds came out
as a special.
And you go, well, you kind of jumped the gun here.
Yeah,
you
know, I got just a whole another season and a half to go.
It's like, why are their uniforms different? You know, but we used to watch it every Friday night. It used to come out and we'd watch a Star Trek when the Friday that it'll come out, and we were all enamored with it. There was nothing. We were all going like, yeah, it's Trek, it's back.
And that's David said something to me like ages ago.
That would be me.
Well, I'm talking to the audience. Okay. I guess like David said something to me ages ago when I started this stuff, and he said that there's no such thing as a bad Trek.
No.
And that really stuck with me because it's true. Like every time you watch something with Star Trek related, there's something.
There's always
going to
be
something.
If you are willing to embrace the Star Trek world, there's always something to get out of it.
Yeah.
Even Star Trek V, which is, we'll come back to that in five weeks, apparently. Yes. But Star Trek V is...
It'll be 12 weeks before we do Into Darkness, right? Yeah.
Star Trek V empirically is not a good movie.
Yeah.
But there's stuff in there. Yeah, we'll talk about that because, you know, there is moments in there where you sit and go, that's a good idea.
Ultimately, I've come to now look at it as like a flying hotel in space. And it's like I get to stay there in that hotel.
It's the science fiction version of the Love Boat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. So you've been watching Star Trek. I've been watching Once Upon a Time. What else? You've been starting something else. So you were talking about something the other day. I'm sure you said something you were watching, and I forgot what it is. But don't worry about it. We'll come back to it next time. We'll come back to it next time. That's fine.
I forgot.
What I do want to talk about very quickly is IMAX, because as you know. I don't like seeing movies in IMAX. Mm. And people out there are going, what?
Why? But because, the screen's so big.
Yeah, big does not mean better, people. This article that was sent in, though, may make me change my mind. Now, this is not available in Australia yet. This is only in, I think, one IMAX in the world at the moment. Wow. But this is the new IMAX projectors. And instead of using traditional bulbs, they use lasers. The idea being that they get much clearer picture, and they're also using two projectors in tandem to make the images sharper and better and everything else. The other thing I really like about this is that basically it's all fed in via the network, so people can actually see exactly what's going on in their projectors, the heat values, the light. They're getting feedback from the light, so they know. So everything is uniform and perfect at all times. And I look at it and go, if our IMAX in Sydney would take this much care, I'd be going back to IMAX.
Yeah.
This is
really interesting.
This is really neat stuff. So basically, if we read from the Gizmodo, it says surround sound and 4K TVs are great for watching movies at home, but there's still nothing like sitting in front of a gigantic screen, which is true. You would think that a gigantic screen would be the right idea. First of all, change the seats.
Yeah.
Those seats, you got to remember, IMAX seats were designed for you to sit for a 20-minute documentary because it was an experience.
That's true.
They've now started showing feature-length films. Yeah. Change the seats, you know?
Yeah, especially going to the bathroom if you have to.
Yeah, and they're real uncomfortable after a
while. I think if I had to go to the bathroom in, well, like we have the world's biggest IMAX in Sydney.
Biggest screen,
It's the biggest one. Yeah, and I think the second one is in New York City where the biggest. It actually says at the front of the IMAX, world's biggest. And the stairs are like in the pitch black.
I trip every time.
I think whenever I'm walking up to my seats, because I should say one of my preferred cinemas is IMAX. I really like going there.
Yeah, see, but I don't.
But I haven't been there since I've been speaking to Dave about the IMAX stuff. So I will have to keep that in mind next time I go. And I always think every time I'm walking up to my seats that if I have to go to the bathroom, I'm going to die. like I'm going to trip and I'm going to fall down like 80 flights of stairs and I'm going to break my neck.
So let's have a look here. Let's see if we can get some facts on this. So it says, as a company, IMAX has always been about making the movie going experience as immersive as possible for the audience. That's why it built a gigantic 120-foot wide screen in a movie theater in Sydney.
Hey, okay.
And why it managed to convince filmmakers to wrangle massive cameras capturing images on giant 70mm film. Seeing an IMAX film is a completely different experience to seeing a movie in a regular theater. Agreed, if the movie is made for IMAX. Mm. Otherwise, it just looks a bit fuzzy.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Like, I'm only going to the IMAX when they're shot on IMAX. like Interstellar, I went.
Well, exactly. Now, it basically says here that they're using two projectors in tandem. And they use a laser projection system to get as much light onto the screen as possible. Now, for those who don't understand how a movie screen works, it actually is it's a combination of a screen that is actually made. If you go up to a movie screen and actually look at it in really close detail, it's made of little glass balls. Yeah. The idea is it's reflective. So when that
I'm about to clean those bastards.
So when the projector light hits it, it reflects back on you, right? And that's what's giving you. So if that screen, if you just fired it onto a white sheet, it would be so dull from the amount of throw it has to do that it wouldn't be worth watching. So these screens are hundreds of thousands of dollars in themselves. And I believe you were saying the Sydney one redid its screen.
Think it was something to do with like some silver something. I don't remember. But it was recent. It was around The Dark Knight Rises.
Right.
When was that? 2008?
No, later than that. I'm thinking Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Dark Knight Rises.
Maybe 2012-ish. Whenever it was. It was around that time period.
So basically what they're saying is the side-by-side dual projector setup in this helps improve sharpness, which is one of the problems I have with IMAX, reduce the jagged aliasing. Now they're saying 35mm is actually referred to as having an unlimited resolution because there's no pixels. So you can keep blowing it up. Digital projection has pixels, and on your 55-inch TV at home, you don't notice those pixels, but when blown up to 120-foot wide, you start to see those pixels.
Becoming very clear,
so basically, using two of these projectors side-by-side, it helps reduce the pixelation and the artifacting, and it also helps with the curved edges of digital images. On a 50-inch 4K TV, it's all but impossible, but on this, it's huge. So, where are we? We keep going down to our facts. And here it says, on top of all that, IMAX's quality control system means that the theater experience as a moviegoer in Sydney has if you're in Sydney and you have this system, you'll have exactly the same cinema experience if you're sitting in a cinema somewhere else.
That's because very promising,
it's all
actually
controlled by a central hub at IMAX HQ. And they'll be able to spot anything that's going wrong.
That's one problem for people like us, hey, is that we can't not see it.
No, it's exactly.
Like, and the amount of times that there is a missed screening or like a badly projected film is enormous. Every second time I go, and most people wouldn't notice it, but you know, we know.
Yeah, like, and the other thing you find is people sit there and go, oh, I don't like 3D because 3D is always too dark.
Yeah.
The reason it's too dark is because the cinemas are saving money by lowering their bulb temperature.
Yeah, or forgetting to change
the lens on it.
Yeah, because I should say I worked in a cinema for about 7 years. Like, when I was younger, and like I've been in and out of projection rooms, and I've seen how all of this works, and I was there for when they crossed over from 35mm to digital,
right?
You know, and I remember all this stuff, and like I'd hear horror stories. You know, like the cinemas, you got to remember, most cinemas you go into are run by 15-year-olds.
Yeah, and most multiplexes have one projectionist for 7 cinemas.
Yeah,
and they're running around.
And now the problem with the digital projection stuff is that now it's all run from an iPad within an office.
Mm.
Like one of my friends, I won't name who, but he became a head digital person
right.
for one of the big cinema chains. And he said, we were standing on a street corner once, and he goes, do you want to know how crazy it is now with the digital technology? And he pulled out his mobile phone, and he literally had an app where he could access every cinema, and it's like looking through a TV guide. And so he'd go through, and he'd go, what's your local? So Chatswood. He goes, oh yeah, there's a such and such in Chatswood. So he opened it up, and he goes, here's what's playing right now. And it had it looked like a download bar.
Right.
For each movie. It would show you how long they were into the movie. Like, and he goes, I can press pause right from here. And we were miles away.
That's ridiculous.
And it's crazy. And it's like, that's how it's happening now, is that the big problem is that when a problem happens, the manager has no clue how to fix it.
And the projectionist is probably not even in the
and
building.
And the projectionist is miles away, expected to like get on a
That's silly.
It's crazy. Anyway, that's the world we're living in now.
Yeah,
like, it's absolutely insane. You know?
So, you know, there's hope for IMAX, and I'm not a huge IMAX. I'm not going to say that I don't like IMAX. Every now and again, that big cinema experience is kind of fun. But at the same time, I don't find it the ultimate cinema going experience that I should.
Mm.
And I'm wondering if we improved the seats and we improved the projection, I think we could be onto something.
Yeah.
It would be nice watching movies in enormous sizes. That could be fun.
What about LIMAX?
I don't, you know, funnily enough, I don't mind LIMAX. In fact, we've got a LIMAX, for those who don't know what LIMAX is, the IMAX branded cinemas that aren't really IMAX. Yep. They're using IMAX technology, but the cinemas are just very large cinemas. They're not actual IMAX formatted screens. We have one here at the Entertainment Quarter, which I actually prefer, because we've got really nice seats in that cinema, because it is actually the screen quality is fantastic and the sound is immense.
It's actually every time I go to the Entertainment Quarter, I never have a problem.
No.
I think they're really well run.
I really like it. That's actually
one
my favorite
of the
cinema.
I think
the Hoyts at Entertainment Quarter is actually currently my favorite cinema in Sydney. And if I can go there, I'll go there beyond anything else. I like the seats. I like the cinema. It's a nice feel. Yeah. There's lots of good restaurants around.
I think I agree with you 100%.
Let's get away from cinemas for a minute and talk about...
If you want to find us.
Talk about some stylistic choices that I...
We saw the movie, today's movie at Entertainment Quarter.
Yes, we did. Mm. We saw it together the other night. How about a 300, a 300 style retelling of Romeo and Juliet? And if that's not good enough for you, how about the Ninja Turtles director is taking a King Arthur story and making it Unforgiven style? All right, enough said. I don't know. Look, I just look at it and go, you know what? What's wrong with just telling the story?
Yeah.
Do we have to like make it all?
Can we find a new movie to
make?
Yeah. Isn't there already 100 King Arthur movies in production? I guess. Guy Ritchie.
Well, there's
doing
two.
One.
Guy Ritchie's is another one, and this is so there's two currently in production. We're not going to show it here because Dave doesn't like watching trailers.
Yes.
Let me just let you know that there is a link in our show notes to First Showing who have had the embedded link to the second TV spot for the Avengers Age of Ultron. It is jizzworthy. All right. This is an amazing trailer. All right. And it's just, it gives away a lot of stuff. Yeah. But boy, if you just want to see the Avengers in action, go for it.
My anticipation is beyond control. I guess.
I believe I wrote in my show notes, it will blow your fucking mind. Yeah. All right. All right.
Get it away. I don't want to read the description.
Oh, yes.
Don't look at that yet. We're not up to that section yet.
Okay. I just saw a weird food.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a minute. Let's, first of all, talk a little bit about our film review. So this week we're going to talk about Big Eyes, directed by Tim Burton and written by Scott Alexander, and I can't pronounce the second guy's name. Larry Karaszewski?
Karaszewski?
I don't know. It does not star Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter. Instead, it stars Christoph Waltz and Amy Adams, and, oh yeah, Kristen Ritter, Danny Houston, Jason Schwartzman, Terrence Stamp, and John Polito are also in it. According to IMDb, the...
I always anticipate these. Yeah,
look, according to IMDb, this is the synopsis.
I'm laughing.
You tell me if this does justice. A drama about the awakening of the painter Margaret Keane, her phenomenal success in the 1950s, and the subsequent legal difficulties she had with her husband, who claimed credit for her works in the 1960s. I think there was a little bit more than that. But anyway,
a little bit more.
Here's the trailer for those who have not seen the film yet.
This is what it's come to, huh? You are the only living soul I can tell my secret to.
I painted every single one of them. Every big eye. Me. And no one will ever know but you.
You made it! You're at North Beach!
Come on, let's have some espresso.
What's that? Is that like reefer?
You have a lot to learn.
What's your name?
Margaret. Wouldn't you rather flirt with those girls down there?
No, I like you, Margaret.
Well, this is all happening mighty quick.
I am a divorcee with a child. Walter is a blessing.
You're gonna love this stuff.
Why are their eyes so big?
The eyes are the windows of the soul.
That's why I paint them so big. I've always done it that way.
Why are you lying?
Sadly, people don't buy lady art.
The painting says keen.
I'm keen, you're keen.
Smile.
We're sold out.
They adore you, big eyes.
He sells paintings, and he sells pictures of the paintings, and he sells postcards of pictures of the paintings.
Good God, it's a movement.
So, are you flipping for all this?
Honestly, I can't believe I live here.
I remember when Mama painted that.
You're confused. I painted that.
What is troubling you?
I lied to my child. I'm just not that kind of person.
Is your husband that kind of person?
These paintings are a part of my being. Maybe I could sign it myself.
That sounds a bit confusing, doesn't it? Keen means me.
Do you want to give back the money? If you tell anyone, this empire collapses.
If that's the price. It's like a mirage. From a distance, you look like a painter. But up close, there's just not much there.
That's an outrageous statement!
Mom!
She's unhinged.
You don't even know what the truth is!
So, who is the artist?
Right, so the thing I said to Dave when we came out of this movie was the biggest shame about this movie is it's stillborn.
Yeah,
it's dead before it comes out.
Yeah,
and that's not indicative of the quality of the film.
No,
it is the fact that nobody knows what it's about. Mm. And when you said, like, as an example, I was at work and I said, I'm going to the movies tonight. They said, what are you saying? I said, Big Eyes. They said, what's that?
Yeah.
Then you say, it's the new Tim Burton film. And they all go, oh, I don't like Tim Burton.
Yeah.
So basically what's happened is it's a plague. It's dead before it starts.
Yeah.
That being said, it's a real shame because it's actually a good film.
And it's kind of also, it's like, I kind of felt about it like, it's like reading an old newspaper or it's like seeing a DVD played in the cinema. It's like, I feel like this movie came out so long ago in the United States that
it did.
That now it's kind of like, well, all the buzz around it's gone. And it's kind of like, here's some trash for you.
There, though? That's the problem.
Well, it got all those award nominations, yeah. I suppose. And I don't know. Burton. It's Burton not being.
It's Burton. Burton kind of killed his career because he did the same thing over and over and over again with the same cast. We must point out that this is the first Tim Burton film that does not star Johnny Depp or Helena Bonham Carter since 1996. We're talking a very long time that he hasn't had one of those two actors in his film.
No, because Sleepy Hollow is Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, it's been a while.
That's crazy.
Oh, you got to remember, Edward Scissorhands was Johnny Depp.
Is it Mars Attacks? Is that that?
Mars Attacks has...
Is that the last one?
That might have been it.
That, maybe that's it. Maybe Helena Bonham Carter's in that.
Should well be.
Johnny Depp's definitely not in
that. No. So... The thing about this
film, I love Tim Burton too. Well, I used to. I used to, and I still kind of am a bit of an apologist. Like, I'll still try and, like, to some extent.
Do you know what it is?
But I can't really defend Alice
in
Wonderland.
It's something you said. It's something you said during our talk about Star Trek.
Mm.
There is something to like in every Tim Burton film. Alice in Wonderland still looks magnificent. Mm. You know, it's visually, it looks magnificent. The 3D sucked, but that was because it was an early conversion. And story-wise, it kind of sucked. Yeah. And Johnny Depp dancing at the end kind of sucked.
That's right.
But visually, and Alice herself looked like she was brain dead. But, you know, the film visually was very pretty.
Mm.
And the film made $1 billion at the box office, you know. I kind of look at Dark Shadows.
Willy Wonka too.
And Willy Wonka was kind of the same thing. I actually think Willy Wonka is a better film.
Yeah.
I think Dark Shadows is a particularly bad film.
Yeah. See, even then I really enjoyed a lot of Dark Shadows.
I like its visual. Once again, one thing that Tim Burton is always very, very very, very consistent with is visually he is a visionary. He is a very clever person when it comes to what a film looks like. His attention to detail is remarkable. Even in this film, which is, for all intents and purposes, Big Eyes is him going back to a low budget.
Mm.
The idea was to do a low budget film with not very many special effects. Yes, you've got the eyes, you know, being large on some people and stuff like that, but... And it's still
even then it's subtle.
It's very subtle, and there's a lot of digital matte paintings with the period detail and stuff like that. But... very little in the way of stylized special effects. $10 million budget for him is nothing.
Yeah, and especially what they did, it's kind of seems small, doesn't it?
And it's just an intimate drama about this true event, which is a husband taking the credit for his wife's work to the point where it ended up in a court of law.
Yeah.
And both Amy Adams and Christoph Waltz, I think, did an amazing job. Mm. Christoph Waltz is, I mean, he's very watchable.
He can read the phone book.
Yeah, he's like, very watchable.
Super entertaining. Yeah.
And Amy Adams plays Damage. I thought the rest of the cast was completely
superfluous. Yeah.
And realistically, Jason Schwartzman and Terrence Stamp both phoned it in.
Yeah.
I mean,
could have been cut out of it.
Yeah,
entirely.
They didn't have to work at all.
And Kristen Ritter was a weird character.
Was a weird character because she was really an exposition character. She was somebody that Amy Adams could talk to just. And she's only in the film three times, I think, in the whole film.
You know, I think so.
I think it's only like three appearances in the whole film. And it really is. But then you look at the film and there's that wonderful scene where they're getting married where you've got the color pastels or when they're on the beach and you've got that beautiful pastel blue sky and the pastel blue ocean. And it's like the color grading on this film is fabulous.
It's gorgeous,
you know? And the framing is beautiful. Every shot looks like
a
painting.
It's a gorgeous movie, I think.
It's gorgeous
like,
looking.
It's like, and it's just, it's fun. It's light. It's charming, I think. Like it's a really easy watch. Like, do you agree?
I agree, absolutely.
Yeah, like
it's the best thing Burton's done in 10 years.
Yeah, I'd agree with that too. Like, I think this is a solid, like a really good film. It's lacking some sort of
problem. Is you know,
I don't know. I kept like I've been racking my brain over about it like for the last few days because I've been trying to like search for some kind of subtext. I don't know if it's there.
Do you know? Like, do you know what I think the major problem is? I think what you're looking for is something I felt too, which is it feels very lightweight.
Mm.
It doesn't delve very deep. There was never a sense. There's only one scene
but
in the entire film.
But it feels like it's trying to say something the whole time.
Yeah, but there's only one scene in it which actually has a sense of menace.
Yeah.
Everything else, Christoph Waltz doesn't have a sense of menace.
No.
Even when he says, I will, you know, put out a hit on you and kill you.
Yeah.
I didn't feel it.
No.
You know, it's like, it's only that one scene where he's drunk and he's flicking the matches that you kind of go, there's some menace. And if I had more of
and
that.
And you go like, oh, Tim Burton really wants to do a horror movie.
And you go, if I had more of that, it's like, and even the conclusion to that, sorry, minor spoilers, but.
Oh, the trailer we just showed like, yeah, most
but with
of
that
story,
one, he puts a match like, through the keyhole.
Yeah,
and it lights it up, and she can't. Looks like
that's,
she can't.
That's
put,
not really a spoiler because that's midway through the movie. Midway through the movie, it's not any.
It looks like she goes to put it out.
Yeah,
and then they run out the side door.
Yeah,
but they never come back to it.
No,
theoretically, the house is about to burn down.
Yeah.
It's on fire.
That's right. No one puts it out or anything.
Nobody puts it out.
And it's turpentine.
And then we cut to a year later, he's still in that house.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
So he's thinking, what happened to the fire?
Yeah,
you know?
So, I mean, I remember saying something. I was like, I wonder what the movie would have been like if they didn't adhere to the true story of it all. Like, because the true story is like, immediately you know she didn't paint. I mean, that he didn't paint the paintings. And I thought, like, the movie shows you straight away that's the case. Like, that's the plot of the movie. And I thought, like, well, it's a true story and we kind of get... I didn't know the true story. Did you know the true story?
I knew of the true story,
yeah,
yes.
So, but you even if you didn't, like, I didn't, but I had an inkling of how it was
going. I remember the big guy's paintings. I mean, because they were all the way into the 70s, they were still quite a phenomenon. So.
Sure. Because I had the inkling I knew how it was going to end. Like, it was going to resolve in a courtroom case or legal action. And yeah, so basically it's like I thought if they had not adhered to that, if they'd kept it ambiguous, like if they played it as if you never knew.
Did she or didn't she?
Or did he paint them? Like if you never showed any painting, then it might have had this missing menace. It might have had this missing tension.
Mm-hmm.
Like and it might have had room to grow a bit more. Like it might have.
Maybe,
had,
but I mean, I guess that depends on
whether
or not. But
I don't know, that's the thing. I wonder what it would have been like. It could have been worse.
But that then you get into that argument, which is, are you making a biopic or are you loosely basing it on a real event, you know?
Yeah, like that's what I mean. Like, what
if you're going to make a film about Keane,
yeah,
you kind of need to
you
adhere
need
to,
the to adhere to it. Yeah, but if it had just been, let's do a story about painters, you know, yeah, because like I guess like at the heart of the movie, it just ends up being like about credit. I suppose it's like,
yeah,
like, and that's kind of what makes it empty in a weird way. It's that like it's as empty as the artworks.
Well, it's also
are.
Kind of look. Like, I think we can go a bit deeper than that because it is actually about. According to IMDb review, that IMDb synopsis, it is about her awakening there because she is a doormat.
No, yeah, absolutely.
For the beginning of it, when she leaves her first husband, she then falls into Keane's arms and she's a doormat through all of that. And it's at the 3-quarter mark where she finally wakes up and says, God damn it, this is my life.
Yeah, it's the.
And takes control to the point where she goes on that radio show and says, I painted them. Mm. And that starts the whole legal proceedings.
Yeah.
But I think that's the core of the film is about her waking up from being just a little submissive doormat and saying, no, damn it, this is my life.
Yeah, this is my life. This is what I need. Yeah. And that's why I thought, like, I should explain that Kristen Ritter's character, she shows up a few times and it's very oddly communicated every time she shows up. She's framed weirdly or she comes in and out of the frame. It led me to...
She always seems to also be there exactly when Margaret needs her.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it led me to believe that, like, she was an imaginary character. And this wasn't the case. I was just interpreting it incorrectly. But actually, like, 2 days after we saw it, I began to think about this, that, like, I wish she was the imaginary character because that would have been interesting. She could have been the person that Margaret
wanted to be. That's not bad, actually. I like that.
Yeah, and I thought, like, that's something that it was missing, maybe. Like,
maybe.
Like,
maybe if you got a little bit deeper in and basically took a few... There is school for thought
like
there.
Like, the only friend she could have was
her
the self
friend.
That she couldn't be.
Well, like, and it kind of comes down to her talking to the dog at that point as well, doesn't it? Because it's like she just needs to talk to somebody.
Yeah, and that's so Tim Burton when you think
William
about
Goldman
it.
In his book Adventures of Screen Trade actually talked about adaptation at one point because he said that when he was writing A Bridge Too Far, he said he was... was it A Bridge Too Far or All the Bridge? No, it was Bridge Too Far, I'm pretty sure it was. And he was saying that he was stuck. Because there were so many characters and so many things that had to be done and this and that and the next thing. And it was another writer that came to him and said, William, it's an adaptation. You're not filming the book.
Yeah.
You're making an adaptation.
Yeah.
And he said it was a freeing experience because suddenly he could amalgam two characters together. He could, even in Schindler's List, the friend, the one that actually writes the list, is actually an amalgam of two different people, right? Because in a movie, you have to take liberties to tell a story because you're still trying to tell the story. And there are times where I think you're right. I think they stuck too literally to Margaret's life. And instead, if they adapted it a little bit, given it something that could have carried it through.
This is what I was thinking. Exactly.
Given it a little bit more dramatic license.
Like yeah, absolutely. Like, and like the thing is, like you look at Tim Burton and what he's sort of what's been happening around him like the last 10 years. It's like just recently he divorced from Helena Bonham Carter, and now they're separated. During the making of this, I guess, if this is the recent movie, then you have him working with Disney and this giant conglomeration with enormous amounts of money. And it's kind of like, I'm sitting there thinking about Big Eyes going like, well, is this part of the movie? Like, because there is some kind of subtext. What if Burton is kind of Margaret? And then you have Disney taking all the credit. Or what if it's got to do with
deep, dude.
Yeah, like if you think about like everybody walks out of a Tim Burton movie lately and they're like, Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
Amazing. And it's like, I'm sure a lot of that is Burton's design.
And also think about it. For the last 10 years, everybody's basically saying Tim Burton's a hack.
Yeah.
That's got to beat down on you
absolutely.
After a while.
And can you imagine as well, your wife, who's a very talented actress, like she's amazing really. Like if you look at even like her work in The King's Speech.
Yeah.
Like, and Fight Club, you know, like,
I'm sorry, Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes. She's the best thing in Planet of the Apes.
Absolutely, yeah. And Paul Giamatti. Yeah. Oh, and that soundtrack.
Soundtrack's good. We'll talk about the soundtrack in a minute. The soundtrack in a minute.
That's also good. But where was I going? Oh, yeah. So, yeah. Can you imagine you're Tim Burton's wife? That's what you're relegated to. And, like, when you think about the movie, it's like, well, Margaret's just relegated to being Keane's wife.
Mm.
And I started to think, like, there's a lot of similarities between Burton's own life and what's happening in this movie. And I thought, is that why he was attracted to it, or did he bring that to it? Or
I think he was attracted to it because it was a way of expressing, a way for him to basically have a little bit more control and tell something more personal rather than just do the $100 million next Disney film. That's fair. He's got to have gotten bored of that.
Yeah, but now he's doing Dumbo.
Well, he's had a breather now.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, he's taking a deep. I want Beetlejuice too. Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian.
Whatever happened to that?
That's supposedly on the way, and Michael Keaton's saying he's going to do it. And
you know, Michael Keaton's getting a bit old for this role now.
Did you see Birdman?
Yeah, but yeah, about a fading movie star.
Yeah, true. Could be about a fading Beetlejuice.
Overall, would you recommend this to a friend?
Totally, absolutely.
Would I. Yeah, I think this is a good return to form for Tim Burton. This shows you that he's not just a one-trick pony.
Absolutely.
It shows you that he does have a little bit more depth. I think he still could have gone further, but he still has the eye of an artist, though, because the film looks
beautiful. And it's like super well acted, and it's like it's quite kind of funny. And
we should say that it's also Tim Burton. So we should say Danny Elfman scored this film, as he does with a lot of Tim Burton films. I mean, let's face it, Tim Burton discovered Danny Elfman.
It's his guy,
But what's really interesting is this is classic Elfman. This is taking Elfman from when he was doing Summersby and
Boingo Boingo stuff.
Well, no, I was actually thinking more of his classic soundtracks, things like Dolores Claiborne.
Sure, that's the one you mentioned when we walked out of the movie.
Dolores Claiborne. And Summers being where his low key, not his oompa 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 music, beautiful orchestra, beautiful orchestrated music, lots of very simplified orchestras where he's not using the whole thing, where he just brings it down to some instruments, lots of percussion. He's a percussionist and a lot of percussion.
There's
great soundtrack, and it is available on iTunes.
There's one more thing I want to mention about it is that I have a degree in visual arts. And this movie nails it.
Right.
Like, if there's one thing that can be said about this movie is, like, that Tim Burton really understands visual arts.
Yeah.
Like, 100%. There's nothing in the movie that rings false or true. There's 100 cute references to, like, you know, Warhol and Campbell's soup. Like, at one point, she's walking through the supermarket and there's a perfect display of Campbell's soup.
Yeah.
And she just, it's very subtle. It's just like she just picks it off the thing and puts it in the trolley.
Everything is planned.
It's meticulous. Yeah. You know?
It looks beautiful. I just gotta say this.
I was seeing you were glancing off.
Just as a side note, suddenly it popped up on my screen that a Qantas boarding pass has just synced to my Dropbox. What's Richard doing? Richard, I don't need your boarding pass, dude.
he's backing up everything important.
He's probably putting it into a shared folder because we have shared folders with Podcast Pillowfort as well.
Of course.
But it just caught my eye because it just popped up and was like, Qantas boarding.
Yeah. He's got you a ticket, Dave.
Hey, I'm going to
surprise.
Oh dear. All right, so Big Eyes. Go
see it.
Enjoy
yourself.
It won't be enjoy yourself. We have a safe flight. Big Eyes, I don't think we'll be at the cinema very long. If you want to see it, go see it.
I'd give it another week
soon.
Really. Based on how empty it was when we were there.
Yeah, it was very empty. And this was a Friday night.
Yeah.
That's not a good sign. All right, let's talk a little bit about weird food. All right, we're going
to
step away from
I'm looking
good film.
Forward to this.
This is a different one for you. We're not going to cover them all because there's actually a lot of them on one page, but I thought I just had to bring this up. This is weird food from around the world. Now, we're going to be reacting to some pictures here, and we're going to talk about what they are. But if you really want to play along at home, you need to open the website,
okay,
click the link,
yeah,
and follow along. Because first thing
we'll
is...
give them a few seconds then, I guess.
Well, they can pause the podcast.
If you're driving.
How about head cheese? This meat jelly is made from the flesh of the head of a pig. Traditionally, this European dish kicks off by cooking vegetables and seasoning. The meat is cooked until tender. The mixture congeals thanks to the natural gelatin found in the skull. It can then be sliced and served on salad.
Okay. Firstly, I'd eat this.
At this point,
yep,
we're looking all right.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
We're looking all right.
Would you eat this?
I don't know. I don't like jellied meat.
Nah,
but,
I'd try it.
I'd try it.
It doesn't look appetizing by any means. But,
no. It doesn't look appetizing, but it doesn't, you know, it looks like ham, basically,
yeah,
with jelly. But how do you feel about frog sashimi?
Fuck. That photo, Jesus.
Frog sashimi, while not
disturbing video.
And I want to say thank you so much to Delta 9 for these.
This is amazing.
I do have to warn you that when you go to this site, you need to have a bit of a strong constitution because some of the things yeah, coming up. This is a uncooked frog served to customers. The chef will cut open the frog in front of you and hand you its still beating heart.
Jesus.
Between a pair of chopsticks. Then the chef will slice and dice it into a plate of raw frog sashimi.
I'm sorry to all the vegetarians listening to this.
Blood sausage, that's nothing new.
I would not eat that.
I don't like blood
sausage. I would not eat the frog. We're doing this one by one.
I would not eat the frog.
I would not eat
blood
that
sausage
frog.
I have tried. I don't like it very much.
What is the blood sausage?
It's sausage comprised of cooked blood and fillers. It's very popular in many countries like Ireland, Scotland, and so forth. It's, you know, there's nothing more disgusting than this in haggis. So, but
yeah,
I've
had haggis.
It's a blood sausage.
Yeah, yeah, I'll try this.
It's just like a sausage, and you fry it up and what have you. And I don't like it. I don't like the texture of it. I don't like the taste of it. But, you know, that's not so wild. But how about koi?
Oh, what's that?
South America, they cook guinea pigs.
Is that the Tasmanian devil?
No, that's a guinea pig.
Or the Jersey devil.
That's where they are. So if you like your little fluffy guinea pigs, don't go to South America because they serve them.
Okay. Why do they serve it like that?
Why do they serve it with the head on? I don't understand meals with the head on it. Bird's nest soup.
I would not eat that. Would you
bird's
eat
nest
that?
Soup, I would never eat. Oh, you mean the koi? Yeah. No. Yeah. I don't eat food that looks back at me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was a vegetarian for a year. I
bird's nest soup is nothing new in this region because they have it in Indonesia and it's actually very popular. It's actually made from, there's a certain type of bird that makes their nests out of their saliva. It's very rare, and what they do is they collect those nests, they boil them down, and it's a very it's a delicacy. The Chinese use it, the Indonesians do it. That's not so weird.
Yeah,
that's
just, I don't know.
I don't think
I
would ever try
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The idea of eating bird saliva.
Yeah, it's the idea of it.
Yeah,
yeah.
But how about baby mice wine? This is the grossest one, I think, on the list. Baby mice wine is little-known Chinese health tonic. Little mice, eyes still closed, are plucked from their mothers and stuffed while still alive into a bottle of rice wine.
This is like some serial killer shit here.
It's horrible. On the bottle, it's got little baby mice on the label. It's horrible. And they're all sitting down at the bottom.
Fucked.
It's just vile. No, I would
not. Yeah, the caption is, yes, this is really sold.
Yeah, this is really sold. Now, I would not eat that. This dish is mainly found in Sardinia. This is a casu marzu, best described as sheep milk cheese. But it contains live insect larvae.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't eat that one. How about fertilized
duck? There's a joke in a Monkey Island video game.
How about fertilized duck embryo? So, we must stress here. We must stress.
Flawless.
We must stress.
I'm not flawless. I'm not flawless.
You're floored.
That was a Freudian penis.
Yeah, you're floored. We must stress that when you eat an egg, it is an unfertilized egg. It's got the yolk and the white and so forth. This is a fertilized egg, so it actually has a little bird inside it. Gah. Okay.
That's beyond
Eskimo ice cream.
Okay, so far it's okay.
A frosty Arctic dish consisting of whipped animal fat with mixed berries.
I guess that's not too bad.
Yeah, I don't think I'd wait. It's also got
I wouldn't want to eat it.
It also has fish and sugar in it.
Oh, so. From local animals like reindeer or seal.
Or seal.
Maybe mixed up.
Yeah, no.
Depending on the availability of game.
Are you ready for this one? Tuna eyeball.
I would never eat it.
I would not eat that. I'm sorry. I look at that and that just looks gross.
But I know people that eat fish eyeballs that love
it. Now, this one looks harmless. doesn't it?
Yeah, that looks
this so is ant larva.
Oh,
so it's called Eskimo. It's ant larva harvested from the roots of the agave plant, considered to be a delicacy in Mexico.
Wow.
Ah. All right, moving on. Fried tarantulas. It's a whole tarantula. It's said that they
She looks like she's really enjoying it.
Doesn't she? It's said that it was first served in Cambodia during the Khmer Rouge because there was food shortages, and they would grab a tarantula from a tree and fry it. Basically, it's now gone on to be a delicacy. It says here they're best plucked straight from the burrow and pan-fried in a bit of garlic and salt. And when you look at the picture, it looks gross.
It looks like chocolate.
Surströmming. A Swedish dish that consists of fermented Baltic herring. Okay, it's fish. Who cares? That doesn't look... It gets a little bit more when you find out that it's actually referred to as rotten fish.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And Rocky Mountain oysters. We're going to stop on this one because we're going to move on to other things. But this is my favorite one. Rocky Mountain oysters is a nice way of saying that they're actually bull calf testicles. Peeled, flattened, and deep fried, and can be found on menus all across America's western states. And do you know what this reminds me of? Do you remember National Lampoon's the Chevy Chase film, the farm one? What's it called? What's that called?
The farm one. It's not Funny Farm.
Funny Farm. Where he's at the cafe and he goes, do you want some more lamb's fries? He goes, yeah, what is this? He goes, sheep's balls. Oh, dear. There's also this one if you want this one. This is a live drunken shrimp.
That's so weird.
Apparently, it's a popular dish. It's a popular dish in China, apparently, where they take freshwater shrimp and they're eaten alive.
They're put in like red wine, so they're drunk.
They're stunned in a strong liquor.
That's ridiculous. Why?
Why would you want to eat it live? Anyway, oh dear.
How many more are there?
That's it. That's the last one. But it does actually say here, and we should stress this, and the video is about to play. Stop video. We don't want you to play. Stop that. It does stress at the bottom of this article that the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade warns smart travelers on the Smart Travelers website to be careful of what you eat overseas. Not all of this food may be that good for you. All right. And that's weird food. And I should stress, there is actually one more weird food coming. Richard almost let the cat out of the bag during Podcast Pillow Fort. I haven't forgotten about it. I'm saving it for the rainy day.
Okay.
I have one up my sleeve, so to speak.
Sure.
I am waiting for the day that Delta Knight doesn't give me one.
Can't find one. Okay.
And I'm going to unleash it upon the world. Delta Knight probably knows what I'm talking about.
Unleash the fury.
And finally, we come to that moment just because we can. Erotic fiction just got weirder. And this is my favorite story of the week, hands down. Had to save it for last before we go out. There has now been erotic fiction written about Clippy. Have you ever just been typing on your Microsoft Word thinking, you know, I think that paperclip's pretty hot? Well, apparently, so has the author... where is it? Leonard Delaney, who has actually written a short piece of fiction, which you can buy on the Amazon bookstore for $3 something, I think it is, all about Clippy. It's believed to be the first, it's called Conquered by Clippy, an erotic short story. And I actually went looking for it because, it's available for £1.99. I actually looked at it the other day. I think it's like $3 Australian. And I thought, if there's porn about Clippy, I need to read it.
Yeah, did you buy this?
No, I didn't buy it because I don't want to buy it, but I was hoping I could find a full text version of
sure,
it.
Sure, yeah.
No, I couldn't find it. If anybody has this,
please
send
please,
it to us.
Please, now.
I don't want to read the whole thing. I just
want
to see
just want
what he
anything,
does. I want
something.
An excerpt from it. The only excerpts they have on the actual Amazon
but
site
teasers,
to buy it
wouldn't they?
Are not porn. I want the porn excerpt. Come on, let's do it. Let's get me the real
does, like,
meat.
Does like the Clippy get like swallowed and like
your guess is as good as mine. I'm waiting. I need to know. All right. So if you guys out there can find me some text on Conquered
by Clippy. Is Jennifer Lawrence in the story?
No, she's just an animated GIF at the bottom. Okay, I don't know why she's there. But apparently
she's making a like what the hell kind of motion.
The author Leonard Delaney has previous titles, known as Motherfucking Wizards, about sexual wizards, Taken by the Tetris Blocks, an erotic story about Tetris, and Sex Boat, about sex on a boat.
Hollywood.
He's waiting for you, all right? Is it going to be the next 50 Shades of Grey? We don't know. Yeah. At this point, I sure hope not.
Are you kidding me? Okay, let's do a quick test, Dave. Okay. I'm going to quickly test you.
Okay.
You're going to the cinema next Thursday night, right?
Yep.
And you see you've got all these options. But playing in the next 10 minutes is a movie called Clippy, an erotic thriller. What are you going to see?
Anything but.
No, in all seriousness.
I don't think I would be seen.
You, David McVeigh.
I don't think I would be seen dead in a cinema going to see an erotic
fiction. But you would sure as shit want to see that
I'd want to see it though, yeah.
That's how 50 Shades, man.
Yeah. Look. I recently got Clippy.
Are you kidding? Maybe she rubs Clippy on her. I don't know. Like,
do you know what the funny thing is? Recently.
It could be a gay thing too with Clippies.
No, it's about a girl. It is about a girl.
Okay, so. Sure. Yeah.
I actually just got my hands on the porn parody of 50 Shades of Grey, which I got to tell you is actually just it's 50 probably, Shades of Grey. Yeah, okay. And you know what? The porn parody of 50 Shades of Grey is a better film than the actual film 50 Shades of Grey.
The movie of Clippy would be like he's the most annoying sexual partner in history. He just keeps popping up all the time.
You look like you want to have an orgasm. You need any help with that?
He's a voyeur. Get out, Clippy.
That's what she
Answer
said.
The question. Answer the question, Clippy.
Dave, I think that's a show. I think we can all say with all honesty at this point, if you agree or disagree with us or you just have something to say, if you want to talk to us about Clippy, please do.
Please write your own Clippy fiction.
Write your own Clippy hot fiction. Send your feedback to feedback. Oh, we do actually have some feedback.
Oh.
In fact, let me finish this by saying send your email to feedback@geekactually.com or you can drop us a voicemail at 02-801-14167. And if you do... You might sound something like this. We have a voicemail from our very good friend and esteemed leader of panels, Richard Gray.
Yeah, hey, David, it's Richard here. Just heard that Geek Actually is coming back soon, which is fantastic. So, look, you know, just let me know when you're ready for me to host. I'm really looking forward to that. I can do a whole completely different set of and welcomes. For that too, so I'm really looking forward to it. Don't tell Dave that he can't be on this one. I think that would be awkward for everyone. But yeah, really looking forward to hosting it. So just let me know. I'm just going to check the site now to make sure I've got all the right details. Some bitches.
Yeah, you missed the boat, Richard.
Richard, that was great.
All right. If you love comic books, we also have another podcast called Behind the Panels where you can hear Richard go and welcome. You can find that at behindthepanels.net.
We got two really fucking good shows for that though.
So this week's, by the time you hear this show, one's already out, and we've also got next week's. Big bumper shows over this next two-week period.
They're really good, actually.
If you love podcasts, Podcast Pillow Fort over at podcastpillowfort.com is a podcast all about podcasts, funnily enough. And you can hear that. That's also hosted by Richard. Yep. Now I see where his joke is coming
from.
That
also just came out, I think, as well, right?
I did. Just came out the other day. Find these great shows, get merchandise, join the Facebook fan page, or follow us on Twitter or on the Twitters by going to geekactually.com. And I should say we are about to start a funding drive. So please be standing by for that. And I really get...
Red alert.
Red alert. Wait. Okay, so I actually, and I don't know how Dave feels, but I actually get really self-conscious and kind of embarrassed about asking for money. So I don't like to do it, and we won't do it very often. But that being said, we do have three Comic-Cons to go to over the course of the next few months. And two of those are actually out of state. And we are going anyway, so don't feel any way obligated whatsoever. But what we are going to do is put in the next couple of weeks a fundraising donations link up on geekactually.com. It'll also be up on behindthepanels.net. And what we are looking for is people to throw us a few bucks here and there. It doesn't have to be a lot. couple bucks here, couple bucks there. If everybody throws in a couple bucks, it's actually quite a lot of money. Mm. And what we're trying to do is help subsidize airfares and hotels.
Yeah.
Because we actually have three people having to travel interstate and stay in hotels.
And I am very, very,
and
very,
Dave's
poor.
Very, very poor. So we are going to help subsidize Dave a little bit by putting a little bit of money into the donation. So if you have a few bucks to spare, please help us out. As I say, we will have more information on that on the site. So go to geekactually.com if you ever want information. If the link is not there when you go there, we haven't put it up yet. By the time you hear this, it's going up in the next couple of weeks. So please listen, stand by for that. And if you can help, that'll be great. For those who don't know what we're talking about, Oz Comic Con last year, we did two panels live shows. We have been invited to come back. We are actually doing the two Melbourne shows, the two Sydney shows, and the two Brisbane shows. And we're going to do panels live on the 2 days of the con in each one of those cities. And it's going to be really exciting. And if you live in those cities, do come and see us because it'll be great.
We're on tour.
We're going to be on tour.
Holiday Row.
And if you want to know, if you are in Sydney and you want to get a little bit of a preview of what we do, on May 2nd, Free Comic Book Day, we will be doing the show live from the Good Game Store in Hurstville. So you can come along to that and you can follow behind the panels. We'll have more information.
And we'll be like reading all of those free books.
Oh, yeah. Just live on microphones. That's all we're going to do. No, we're going to do something more entertaining than that.
Okay. We're going to give out free books.
We give free books at every live show.
We should get books that aren't free, but give them out free. Well, that's whilst what we get free books that we are able to give out.
We've done two live shows at Hurstville Good Games. And in both live shows, we had giveaways from Good Games. They gave us stuff, graphic novels, gaming stuff, pop vinyls. We've given stuff away.
Yes.
So come along to the shows. You might win some shit. You know what I mean? Yeah, so it's good fun. Yeah. That's another show. It's not the Geek Action Show because we couldn't do this live in front of people because we would offend people.
Yes.
And they might hit us.
Yet.
More details on that later to come. Ooh. Find more Dave at damngoodcup.com now that he's paid the bill. And on Twitter at Dave Longer. Find more of me at geekactually.com or on Twitter at David McVeigh. Remember, you can also follow us on Twitter at Geek Actually, and we also have Facebook fan pages, Geek Actually, and Behind the Panels. Do you have anything else to add, my good sir?
God damn you, Bishop!
In that case, we're going to say geek on, everybody, and we'll see you all next week.